Some people live their lives trying to fit in. They want to be part of the crowd. They want acceptance from the majority. They may want to just be kind of swept up in it and not noticed. Or at least they want to. They want to be with those, a part of those who at that moment and in those circumstances are the ones who are in power, let's say. Ones who are making a splash. Others live their lives trying to fit in, trying to blend in because they don't want to be noticed. Kind of got my thoughts mixed up there at the first group. They want to stand out as part of everybody else. This next group here that I'm talking about just doesn't want to be noticed at all. They don't want to be singled out. They want to be swallowed up. There are still others who, although they want to be maybe part of the group, and in some way, really all they want to be is noticed. They want to stand out. They want to be unique. They want to be different. And the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus calls on his followers to be different. He calls on them to be different, but not just for the sake of being different, not just to be noticed. Jesus calls on his followers to be different in order to make a difference for good in their own lives and in the lives of others. Pretty much in every passage in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus calls his followers to be different, to react differently than most people of the world react, to treat others differently than most people in the world treat others. In Matthew 5, verses 10 through 12, for example, Jesus tells his followers to rejoice when they are persecuted for righteousness' sake. In Matthew 6, 19 and 20, Jesus tells his disciples to not lay up treasures on earth, but to lay up treasures in heaven. These are not ordinary approaches to life. In Matthew 6, verses 25 through 34, Jesus tells those who desire to be citizens of the kingdom not to worry about their life, not to worry about food or clothing, but to trust in God to take care of them. And in Matthew 7, verses 13 and 14, Jesus warns of the danger of trying to fit in with the crowd when he says, "Wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and there are many who go in by it. Narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it." This morning we're going to look at a short passage found in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount. We're going to look at Matthew 5, verses 38 through 42. That text says, "You've heard the law that says the punishment must match the injury, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek also. If you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too. If a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. Give to those who ask and don't turn away from those who want to borrow." Jesus began this segment of the sermon by citing what has been referred to as the oldest law in the world, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That law is known as the Lex Talionis, which is Latin for the law of retaliation. Lex is Latin for law, and talionis is Latin for retaliation. The law of retaliation has been described by some as the law of tit for tat. It appears in the earliest known code of laws called the Code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi was a king who reigned in old Babylon, somewhere within a couple of hundred years, a couple of centuries of around 2000 BC, depending on who you ask. I've seen it from the late 1700s. I'm trying to go back that way. to the almost 2,300, and then some say 2,000. So somewhere in that area, around the time, a couple of centuries connected with Abraham. I understand that centuries later, the Greeks and the Romans had the same law. And so sometime around the middle of all that, middle 1400s, the Ten Commandments and the Old Law was given to Moses. The Lex Talionis, the law of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is stated in the Old Testament books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. The passage in Leviticus is Leviticus 24, verses 19 and 20, and that text reads, "Anyone who injures their neighbor is to be injured in the same manner. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The one who has inflicted the injury must suffer the same injury." These laws are often quoted as among the most bloodthirsty, savage, and merciless laws of the Old Testament. But this shows a gross misunderstanding of the purpose of such laws. If two men get into a fight and one man intentionally or unintentionally puts the other's eye out, the natural response of the brothers or relatives or friends of the injured man would be to go find the guy who did that, put out his eye, and maybe break his nose and both his arms and both his legs. Something like that. Revenge is rarely satisfied with pure justice. Pure justice is a balancing of the scales. Pure justice says whatever harm was done to me, the exact same harm should be done to you. No more, no less. There were several things the Lex Talionis did. Demanding an eye for an eye held people responsible for the harm they did to others. But primarily, the law of retaliation was a restriction on unlimited revenge. The law of an eye for an eye demanded compensation or justice for the harm done to others. But this law also kept people from forcing the offender to pay a greater price than the offense deserved. The Lex Talionis also kept people from taking personal revenge by taking vengeance out of the hands of the one who was harmed and putting it into the hands of civil authorities. And the law of retaliation mandated that the punishment fit the crime. Again, whatever harm was done to the one, the exact same harm should be done to the other, no more and no less. And it needs to be said that the Old Testament law did not teach the Jews to hate others and to seek revenge. The old law taught them actually to love others, to show mercy and kindness to their enemies, and to forego retaliation. Leviticus 19:18 says, "Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Proverbs 25:21 says, "If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink." Proverbs 24:29 says, "Do not say, 'I'll do to them as they have done to me. I'll pay them back for what they did.'" And so the old criticism that if everyone followed the law of an eye for an eye, pretty soon the whole world would be blind, misses the purpose of the law entirely. The law was intended to guarantee justice and to prevent people from carrying out a harsher punishment than the original crime. And though the law of an eye for an eye was about justice for harm done, Jesus referred to that law and basically said, "Now I'm calling you to a higher standard. I'm calling you to a nobler response." And so again, in Matthew 5, verse 38, Jesus said, "You've heard the law that says the punishment must match the injury, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Then in verse 39, Jesus went on to say, "But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, offer the other cheek also." Due to the fact that most people are right-handed, This text seems to imply that this is a backhanded slap across the face. To slap someone on the right cheek with your right hand can be done naturally only by using the back of your hand. Think about that. There's the right cheek. Here's my right hand. It's kind of hard to do this and be very effective. So it's, and to use the open hand is really a very hard slap. There are fighting championships that are open-handed. You can actually knock someone out with an open-handed slap on the face if you know how to do it. But a backhanded slap would not really hurt that badly, and it wouldn't injure that badly either. It's an open assault and a clear personal challenge to a fight, but pretty much in every culture, a backhanded slap across the face is considered to be an insult primarily intended to humiliate. We're told in John 19, verses 1 through 3, that Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they slapped him in the face. Again, this treatment was intended primarily to humiliate. In 1 Peter 2, verses 21 through 23, we're told, "You were called to suffering because Christ suffered for you, leaving an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly." And in 1 Peter 3, verse 9, Peter tells us, "Do not repay evil with evil, or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing." I believe Jesus is using this example to speak broadly about being insulted in a personal way. It's hopefully rare that anyone would ever slap us across the face. But what if someone does not slap us, but they insult us verbally? Would it be okay to insult them back? Because Jesus didn't really say, you know, you couldn't do that verbally if they, you know, I believe Jesus used the most extreme version of an insult, being backhanded, in order to make the point that even if someone insults you in the worst way possible, but that would include lesser ways, even then you should respond in a way that glorifies God. Whenever someone insults us physically or verbally, Jesus is telling us to respond with gentleness and grace. He's calling us to be like him. Striking back or hurling an insult at them takes no integrity. Anybody can do that. But it takes integrity to refuse to retaliate, and it takes even more integrity to treat the person with kindness when they have insulted you. In Romans 12, 17 through 21, Paul says, "Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. If it is possible, as far as depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath, for it is written, 'It is mine to repay, it is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink." We read that earlier in Proverbs. "In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." In the next verse, Matthew 5, verse 40, Jesus goes on to say, "If you are sued in court and your shirt is taken from you, give your coat too." Other translations say, "When someone sues you for your coat or your tunic, let them take your cloak also," or "let them have your cloak also." The shirt or the tunic was an undergarment which could be demanded as a legal fine or a pledge. The coat or the cloak was an outer garment. Even the poorest man would have a change of shirts or tunics but the coat or the cloak was a blanket-like outer garment which was worn as a robe by day, and it actually served as, it was used as a blanket by night. An ordinary Jew would have only one of these. A man's shirt or tunic might be taken as a pledge, but in Exodus 22, verses 26 and 27, the old law said, if you take your neighbor's cloak, the outward garment, as a pledge, you must return it by sunset, because that cloak is the only covering your neighbor has. What else can they sleep in? The Christian never demands his rights to someone else's harm, because he considers others before he considers himself. As Paul told us in Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. Next, in verse 41, Jesus said, if a soldier demands that you carry his gear for a mile, carry it 2 miles. If you lived in the time of Christ, a Roman soldier could come up to you at any time and tap you on the shoulder with the flat side of his spear. You would then be required to carry his armor or his baggage for up to 1 mile, literally 1,000 paces. This was one of the burdens of being a nation ruled by another nation. Everyone resented this kind of treatment, of course, but Jesus said, don't resent it. He said, be kind, be helpful. The first mile was mandatory, but going the second mile was going above and beyond the call of duty, but that's what Christ calls us to do. This text is a lesson on attitude, and it's about foregoing your rights for someone else's benefit. Jesus is saying, don't go a mile with bitter and obvious resentment. Instead, go 2 miles with cheerfulness and good grace. And finally, in verse 42, Jesus says, give to those who ask and don't turn away from those who want to borrow. I don't believe any of these examples are to be taken to extreme. For example, to give money to someone who you know is just going to go buy drugs or alcohol with it is not only encouraging them to continue in their destructive behavior, but it's also poor stewardship of what God has given us. In 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, Paul said, even when we were with you, we gave you this rule, the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat. Sometimes what people need is to be told no. Giving people everything they want only makes them weak and ungrateful. But we should give liberally to those who are truly in need. The next few verses also tells us that Christ's followers must be different. Matthew 5, verses 43 through 45, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Jesus taught that not only should we not hate our enemies, but that we should love them and pray for them. When we pray for our enemies, it takes the poison out of our attitudes. About 40 years ago, someone I know was half owner of an industrial supply store. He was a deacon in the congregation where I attended. His name is Bill. A fire burned down part of his store, and he began selling some of the stock at a discount price because of the damage that was done, the fire damage. He had some sets of drill bits that usually sold for around $200 each. The metal case had fire damage, but the drill bits were unharmed, and he sold several of these sets at a local factory for something like half the price, like $100. And After he'd sold a few of these, one guy approached him and tried to take advantage of the situation, and he accused Bill of having sold or having at least told others that he would take $50 for the sets. He was implying, obviously, that Bill was trying to cheat him. Bill simply took a set of the drill bits and handed them to the guy and said, "Here, they're yours." I believe that's what Jesus is teaching in this passage. He's saying that's the kind of attitude we're supposed to display when others insult us or when they try to take advantage of us. Most of us occasionally make mistakes when driving. You may already do this, but the next time you make a mistake when you're driving, try looking at the person you've offended and genuinely telling them, "Sorry." And don't be surprised if they're glaring at you or yelling at you or using a sign language or something. They usually don't know how to act, and they'll often turn their head and look the other way when you do this. If you look at them and say, they kind of freak out momentarily. And the next time somebody else makes a mistake when driving, they've cut you off, or in some way they've wronged you in terms of driving rules. The next time that happens, try looking at them and smiling and wave and tell them, "It's okay. It's okay." The look on their face is priceless. More often than not, they won't look at you, so you're trying to get their attention, and they won't look because they don't want to be publicly abused and humiliated. But if you manage to make eye contact, and instead of showing frustration or anger, you show them grace, you smile and wave, or in some way you make it clear that it's okay, they have such a look of relief and gratitude on their faces. It's been said that Jesus replaced a law with an attitude. And I think that's a pretty good way of seeing the passage we've just looked at. Christians do the right thing not to impress others, but they do the right thing because it's the right thing to do. Jesus is teaching us that people, relationships are more important than driving rules. People, relationships are more important than being right. And Jesus is teaching us that people, relationships are more important than an insult or a momentary inconvenience. If we would be disciples of Christ, if we would pattern ourselves after Him and follow His teachings, we must extend grace to others. We must be different from most others in the world. He calls us to that.